from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am your host, Rob Watson. We have, as always, an informative and, I think, fascinating packed radio show prepared for you tonight. On deck in our expert journalist panel will be Brody Levesque and Karen Oakham, two of the finest writers you could find in media today. And coming up, we will have a very special guest, a historically great guest, Fred Karger, who is the first and only openly gay man to have run for president under the Republican banner, under any banner for that matter, I believe. I don't recall a Democratic gay candidate for president either. He did run in the race that ultimately went to Mitt Romney. We are going to find out what he is up to, which is taking on another big institution, and that is the LDS Church, which he is a solid activist and has lots of inside info. And so this is a program you simply do not want to miss. Before we get into that, we want to go into today's exclusive headlines provided to us by none other than Brody Levesque. Brody, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Rob. Headline news for Thursday, February 15th, 2018. In South Korea, Eric Radford announced that he will retire after becoming the first out gay man to win a gold medal at a Winter Olympics. The Canadian athlete took home the gold by figure skating to the tune of Adele's Hometown Glory, alongside his teammate Megan Dummel. They later earned a bronze medal in pairs figure skating, making Eric the first openly gay man to win multiple Olympic medals. Donald Trump Jr. attacked out-gay figure skater Adam Rippon on Twitter for the gay athlete's remarks about U.S. Vice President Mike Pence. During a press conference in Pyeongchang, Adam told reporters that he did not want his, quote, Olympic experience being about Mike Pence. The controversy started when the Olympian skater told reporters that he'd refused to meet Pence. Rippon was quoted as saying, "You mean Mike Pence, the same Mike Pence that funded gay conversion therapy? I'm not buying it." Rippon added, "I don't think he has a real concept of reality. To stand by some of the things that Donald Trump has said, and for Mike Pence to say he's a devout Christian, man, is completely contradictory." Well, this did not sit well with Trump Jr., who tweeted in response, "Really? Then perhaps you shouldn't have spent the past few weeks talking about him. I haven't heard him mention you once." In Los Angeles, nearly 5 years after 8-year-old Gabriel Fernandez was murdered because his mother's boyfriend thought Gabriel was gay, the boy's mother pleaded guilty to first-degree murder, according to the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office. In Washington, CNN is reporting a stinging defeat after months of negotiations to resolve the docket deadlock before the March 5th deadline. Senators failed to advance a bipartisan proposal to resolve the future of millions of young, undocumented immigrants, leaving talks seemingly back at square one. The much-anticipated bipartisan deal would have paired a pathway to citizenship for nearly 2 million undocumented immigrants who came to the United States as children, with $25 billion in border security and some other measures, failed to get the 60 votes necessary to advance the legislation after furious White House opposition. The final vote was 54 to 45. A more conservative plan preferred by the White House also failed, 39 to 60. The Associated Press reported that the Florida teenager accused of using a semi-automatic rifle to kill 17 people at a high school confessed to carrying out one of the nation's deadliest school shootings and also concealing extra ammunition in his backpack, but we still don't know what the motive was or if he even had one. According to Broward County, Florida Sheriff Scott Israel, 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz admitted to sheriff's investigators that he shot students in the hallways and on the grounds of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, just north of Broward County line and Fort Lauderdale. Cruz told officers he brought more loaded magazines to the school and kept them hidden in the backpack until he got on campus. As panicked students began to run, he told investigators he decided to discard his rifle and the vest he was wearing so that he could blend in with the crowd fleeing the school. Police later recovered the rifle and the vest. Cruz was charged with 17 counts of murder and is being held without bond. He reportedly belonged to a white supremacist group called the Republic of Florida, which has repeatedly harassed and threatened local LGBTQI activists. 13 wounded survivors were still being hospitalized this evening, including two in critical condition. Wednesday's mass shooting was the nation's deadliest school attack since a gunman opened fire at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, killing 27 people more than 5 years ago, and the 17th incident of gunfire at an American school so far this year. In response, a new national effort launches tomorrow called NoNRAMoney.org. Organizers are calling on all candidates for public office to pledge that they will not take money from the National Rifle Association nor tout their NRA ranking, and instead will pursue common sense gun laws. Voters are being asked to pledge to oppose any candidate for any office who takes NRA money or touts a favorable rating by the NRA. Check out hashtag NoNRAMoney for more information. That's the news for today. Rob, back to you.
Thank you so much, Brody. A lot there and a lot going on. Before we move ahead, I do want to welcome our other panelist, Karen Oakham, to the show. Karen, good evening.
Hey there. It's a very heavy news day.
Very
lots
heavy news
to talk about.
Lots to talk about, and we have the man of the hour to talk to about it. And without further ado, I'd like to bring him on. Fred Karger, welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks very much. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Fred.
Hi, hello, and it is an honor to have you on. I want to start right off with the topics at hand. Fred, you were in the thick of things in the last, not the most previous, but the one before that presidential cycle, fighting to get your voice heard in that cycle. What is your take on the political climate on how it's changed since then to this most current election in this past year under Trump rule?
I really haven't seen much difference from the Obama days. So, no, I'm kidding, of course. It's you know, a dramatic turn. We're all a part of a reality TV show. And, you know, he does everything in keeping with his 11 years on The Apprentice. Keeps us in suspense and back and forth. And so, I mean, it's a crazy time, and hopefully we will survive it.
What would your advice be to Trump if he brought you in as an advisor in terms of the both the LGBTQ angle, but more specifically as the Republican LGBTQ spokesperson?
And would you accept that if he offered?
I don't think so. I'd be very flattered, but I can't really give Donald Trump advice. He's his own man. I did read the book by the Washington Post reporters, Trump Revealed, and that goes back to his early, well, actually to his father and how his father became, you know, very successful, and then Trump as a young man getting in trouble and talking his way out of it. The whole Donald Trump story. So it really gives you a good glimpse into this guy, and he's not going to change. This is how he's been since he was, you know, thrown out of high school and sent to military school, and I'm sure talked his way out of things and made stuff up and, you know, quite the promoter and salesman. So he is what he is, and it's, yes, it's a little embarrassing as a Republican. I've fought my whole life, really, since I was an adolescent working, for more, you know, mainstream Republicanism, growing the party, the Big Tent Party, being more moderate, trying to get younger people. So Trump is an anathema to all of that, but, You know, he won.
I'd like to ask a question that I think you might be familiar with. Your old friend in quotes, Mitt Romney, was expected to announce that he's running for the seat being vacated by Senator Orrin Hatch. He was supposed to announce that today, but he postponed it because of the shooting. But he is expected to announce his candidacy tomorrow. What do you think Mitt Romney will bring to the U.S. Senate? And will he be, as so many people expect, will he be the sort of loyal opposition to Donald Trump, representing establishment of Republicans?
I don't think he will. I think he tried to go after Trump initially during the campaign, which was very awkward for Romney and pretty much out of place. He wasn't one of his opponents. He just didn't like him from the four-year experience earlier, I guess. But, you know, he just got shot down by Trump. And then, of course, to get even, Trump kind of led him along to think he might be up for Secretary of State and had him come back to the White House once and then meet him in New York. I'm sorry, the transition office once, then meet him in New York at that famous dinner as Jean George, which was supposed to have been with the two wives, but then it ended up being with Reince Priebus. And so, you know, he's just been led along by Trump. So I do not think he will be the loyal opposition. I think he'll be sought after. For one thing, they talk about putting him in leadership. He'll be sought after to run the Senate Finance Committee, you know, or the campaign committee to raise money to try and keep the Senate in Republicans' hands. He's a master at that, has great connections and a lot of personal money. But I don't think he's going to do that. He's gotten off to a bumpy start. And answer the other part of the question, I'm in Utah now. I was hoping to have gone to what was billed as a press conference 2 weeks ago when he said he was going to have a press conference tomorrow, or today rather, but instead they're doing a video or something. So I guess they decided not to face the press. And headlines of both newspapers here, including the Church on Deseret News, which is, of course, you know, big Romney supporter, had said that the state party chairman, named Rob Anderson, had said that he didn't think it was really right for Romney to run, that it was really, you know, there are a lot of great Utahns, and he really hadn't spent much time here, which is true. Of his 70 years, he's here for college, and then he was here for a year and a half for the Olympics. The rest of the time, he's been in Michigan, California, and Massachusetts. So he's off to a bumpy start, which just makes me feel terrible. But I think it's probably his to lose, of course, and it was also carved up for him by the church, who pushed poor Orrin Hatch out of the way. He'd already raised $3 or $4 million for his reelection campaign, so Romney could run and get back in the national spotlight.
Listen, I want to ask a follow-up question, Fred, but I need to do a little full disclosure first, which is that you and I have known each other for a long time, but I also interviewed you extensively regarding Prop 8 and Prop 22 documents that you found regarding the Mormon Church's participation in trying to stop marriage equality. And additionally, you know, I've interviewed you regarding Mitt Romney, especially for an upcoming series for New Now Next. So given that, could you explain to people, because this may come up during his candidacy, there is something called the White Horse Prophecy, which was attached to Mitt Romney's name when he ran in 2012. And he says, no, I have nothing to do with that. But then, as you said earlier about, you were talking about Trump, but you've read everything on the Mormon Church and Romney. You know, there are books, there are stories going back to his school days when there was a kind of an assumption that he was the anointed one. And, you know, this time people might be a little bit more clued in to ask him about his relation to the Mormon Church, much in the same way that people asked John F. Kennedy about his relation to the Catholic Church and the Vatican And JFK said, no, I would not be run by the Vatican. But some people are not so sure if Mitt Romney would not take his marching orders from the LDS Church. What do you think? And could you explain that White Horse prophecy, please?
Okay, sure. First, the White Horse prophecy was something that Joseph Smith, who's the founder of the Mormon Church, came up with. And he was a very smart guy and calculating. He had run and won for the mayor of Nauvoo, Illinois, which was where the Mormon Church was at the time. So they come in with 1,300 Mormons and they take over the town. So as a part of that, they believe in taking over the world. And in order to do that and to really save the world, we need a Mormon president of the United States. And so, you know, as you said, I agree 100%. Romney, whose father was very prominent, head of one of the big four automakers, and he was governor of Michigan. He was in the Nixon cabinet. He ran for president himself, two or three-term governor of Michigan. So, I mean, this guy, was going to be the first Mormon president, tried and had some problems with this, but then his son, the golden boy, was groomed to do that. And so that White Horse prophecy, and there was a great story by Time magazine during the campaign, talking to one of the granddaughters, great-great-granddaughters or something, of Brigham Young, I think, who was the second president, who told them all about it. And it's a little hard to believe, and it sounds science fiction-y and crazy, but it is absolutely something the Mormon Church believes in, that it's necessary for a Mormon to be elected president of the United States to really save the nation and save the world. And so Romney, by virtue of being back in the spotlight, if he wins the Senate seat or even just campaigning for it, will be, have that same opportunity like Biden or somebody else. Maybe the third time's the charm, but at least the church wants him visible and out there and at least ready to assume the White Horse prophecy and be elected president of the United States. So, you know, there's that whole side of it. And they are very calculating and very impressive. And I think you know, but your listeners might not, that as I was following the money doing the opposition research in 2008 during the Prop 8 campaign, seeing where all the money was coming from, boycotting some of the biggest donors to Yes on Aid, I discovered all these names I'd never heard of, Googling, which was pretty new back in 2008, and there was a commonality. They'd gone to BYU, they'd given to Mitt Romney, and anyway, I figured out this was Mormon church-led fundraising to the tune of about $400,000 to $500,000 a day in the summer of 2008, and I gave the story to the Wall Street Journal. And the church has never quite been the same since. And I've been a thorn in their side for the last 9 years, going on 10 now this November. And that's what I've been up to. And love to talk about that a little bit, because we got a few good, exciting things going on with that, and set up an organization called Mormon Tips to get tips from people like I've gotten before. And hopefully we can find information out about the church and fight back against them.
And that's MormonTips.com?
Yes, it is. Thank you, Karen.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Fred, that was what I wanted to ask you about, your thorn in the side activities. In your video that you have on your website, you really honed in on the suicides of Mormon kids and, as a result of activities from the church. I've written on different pieces about the things the church has done, including their the one a few, I guess it's over a year ago now, where they essentially told kids that they had to walk away from their parents or be excommunicated. And there was reports of suicides that happened as a result of that, although documentation of those suicides was not really easily come by. It seemed to be more anecdotal. Do you have more information on that? And what is the nature of your activities with the Mormon Church currently?
Sure. Well, it was November 5th, 2016, and it was leaked out before the church was ready to announce it. It was this, they call a policy change, which after it got off to such a terrible, terrible start and caused something like 42 teenage Mormon suicides, and how many more attempts and misery brought by that. And just as you said, Brody, it was saying that if you were, because this was right after gay marriage passed. So now the Mormon Church, by the Supreme Court, that was in June. So this was in, it was 2015. So this was in, I think it was 2015. This was then in November. They decided we got to do something. We can't have gay married people in our church. So they threw out all the gay married couples that were Mormon, and there are plenty. They have a big gay problem in this church. I mean, it's a huge population of gays because they're told if you're gay, just get married, have kids, you'll be fine, and, you know, things happen that don't work out too well. So that November 5th policy just caused this rash of suicides, which got me to do what I'm doing, to set up an organization for the first time instead of just, you know, as they put Prop 22 on the ballot. We spend millions of dollars fighting that. When Prop 8 on the ballot 8 years later in California, we spent $44 million fighting that. So as they're doing all this stuff, all we've ever done is really kind of fight back against legislation, initiatives, referenda, whatever it is, constitutional amendments like Prop 8. And so this time I said, let's put them on the defensive. Let's go after something that's sacred to the Mormon Church. And I heard tips and information about this for those 8 years or so I was working, is that they like to own a lot of businesses and real estate, hundreds of billions of dollars worth. That's billions with a B, maybe even up to a trillion all over the world. They're vast, vast amount of money. And so they like to have that and flex their muscle around. And so that's what I'm looking at right now. We've got an investigative team to see, are they paying property tax? Or, like, that's one of the things I've been doing this week in Utah. I was down at the treasurer's office to see if there are thousands of properties that's owned by the church under various names of kind of shell companies. Some are spelled just slightly differently, but it's literally thousands of properties, many of which take a religious exemption and take other types of exemptions when they shouldn't. That's just property tax. Then they've got life insurance companies, venture capital firms, they own hotels and restaurants, and literally hundreds of billions of dollars. And what we're looking at when we see a lot of these businesses is they're not paying federal income tax because they're claiming a religious exemption. So if you're a life insurance company that's, I'm actually looking at right now, Beneficial Life, which I'd heard of long before I knew the Mormon Church owned it, they make any profit, they can often shield it by either kind of funneling into the church and saying it's a religious contribution or just not paying any taxes on it by saying, you know, we have a religious exemption. And so we've got this team looking all over the world, concentrating on five hotspots right now, and we're finding unbelievable information. Could use a lot more help, tax attorneys, real estate attorneys, anybody who's good at research, any of that. And it's really a treasure trove of very interesting stuff. And so we're going to take it to the IRS eventually. We're giving it to a lot of journalists as we find stuff out to get the story out there. And I'm calling it, you know, an embarrassment of riches. And until they welcome LGBT Mormons and their families back into the church, because they threw them out and their kids, the married, same-sex married couples, their kids got left out of the church until they're 18. And as you said, they have to choose between the parents who raised them and their church. And if they choose their church, they have to disavow their parents' sexual orientation. So it's a wonderful thing. And it's hard to imagine if you didn't grow up in the Mormon church or aren't that familiar with it, but, and I'm not, but what I hear from so many others, just how devastating that policy change was. So they need to change that. They need to welcome LGBTQ Mormons back into the church and their families. And then we'll leave them alone.
Thank you. And by the way, that was Rob asking the question. Brody's up next with a question for you, though, Fred.
Oh,
Brody?
Sorry.
No problem.
Good evening, Fred. We're going to needle the Mormon Church a little bit, and we're going to do a salt park. Can you tell me the concept behind that? Because I absolutely love that idea.
Oh, thanks. Well, so in the course of my last year since I kicked off this Mormon Tips campaign with a couple commercials that we ran in Utah, we ran in Hawaii, where they were filmed and very slick and asking for tips. So I decided, you know, why not try and do something a little different? And I love animation because you can make a lot of points, but you can also do it with humor, which I like, and particularly on something kind of sensitive like this, going, you know, looking into the Mormon Church's tax-exempt status. So I do it with a little humor. So we're doing a parody of South Park, which no Mormon has ever seen, but they'll get a lot of the similarities. And then the show is really a five-part animated series with five kids, a la the kids of South Park, and this is Salt Park, and they're going to be kind of bad kids acting up in school. They get sent to the school counselor, who ends every sentence with "mkay, mkay," similar to South Park. And then they go off on what we're calling the ultimate field trip, where they go to Philadelphia, Orlando, Florida, Hawaii, and then end up in Independence, Missouri. So these are all kind of very prominent Mormon spots where they either own a lot of real estate, or in the case of Independence, Missouri, they've taught and believe that that's where the resurrection, where Christ is coming back to. They even have a corner of land identified where he will come back to. And so we're going to kind of wrap the season up there. We finished episode one. I've been focus grouping it around Utah this week. The ex-Mormons, who really our audience on this, love it. It's a lot of inside stuff, but non-Mormons love it too. And it's South Park quality, very funny, but with a G-rated a rating, because there's no foul language in there. I want Mormons to feel comfortable with it. There's some pretty irreverent stuff in there, but all in good fun. And so that, at the end of each episode, ask for tips. It's done in kind of a unique way. I was looking at venues today. We're going to have a premiere probably the end of next month in Salt Lake of episode one. We've got a team in place making the next four episodes, and then we're going to have a trailer, which hopefully will be out, and you know, love to talk about in a couple weeks that is in the works. So trailer first, episode one, then we're going to be releasing the other four episodes probably every 2 or 3 weeks, or 4 or 5 minutes each, and very fun, and we just ask everybody's help to get it out there and make it go viral. A couple of these other ex-Mormon videos that are out that are not nearly as slick, that are animated, and you know, but in these groups, one had 2.5 million views. So I'm shooting for 1 million views of episode one, which would, of course, be pretty spectacular. But that's the kind of network that we're going after, this ex-Mormon group and Mormons. You know, can't get enough of this stuff.
So basically, you're going to make sure that the quorum of the 12 apostles is a little more than annoyed by this. Sounds good. I like the concept
a
lot, Fred.
That's
really
my plan. I've been annoying them for going on 10 years now, and on all their political misdeeds. And that's been my area of expertise. That's what I did for a living for 30 years. So where they've broken the law like they did after Prop 8 or during Prop 8, I filed a complaint after Prop 8, led to 13-count guilty count against the Mormon Church on election fraud, unprecedented per religion. They had to pay a fine. They were prosecuted, investigated for 18 months. I did the same with their front group, the National Organization for Marriage, a year later in Maine. That was a 5-year investigation, and that's the group that the Mormon Church and the Catholic Church created. They had board members on it, and it was a very costly experience for NOM and their supporters of millions of dollars for 5 years of legal fees, both to the Supreme Court of the United States and to the Supreme Court of Maine. And every step of the way, they lost, and they had to disclose their donors. So, yeah, I've been causing a lot of grief and will continue to until they do the right thing and you know, change with the times.
Very good. Karen, do you have a question?
Yeah, actually, let me follow up on that. Fred, as you know, Thomas Munson, who was the Mormon Church president, just died in January. He was 90. And, you know, he kind of ruled the roost, if you will, you know, having visions and from God and declaring that this is what God says we must do, et cetera. I'm wondering if you think that there's a possibility. I know the guy that just replaced him is like 93 or something like that, so maybe there isn't room for immediate change right away. But do you think that given that these elders are old and they're, you know, there's this kind of attrition thing going on, that there is the possibility that the Mormon Church might modernize, might get with the times? I mean, they're now facing internally, at least, you know, allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment. I mean, the Me Too movement is kind of hitting them in their own fashion. Do you think that they're going to stick with this sort of legacy, as they did so long in rejecting African Americans, as they're still doing with women? Women continue have to be submissive, essentially. And, you know, basically, gay people are okay as long as they don't really identify as gay and don't do anything. Is there a possibility of change now that these old guys are dying off?
It's you know, everyone's guess. The true believing Mormons, even if they've kind of left, that are still holding on to the church, think it'll, you know, take 30 or 40 years, but eventually it'll change. I'm not that patient a person, and I'm looking at it from the outside. I've seen all the change they've done to try and right the ship of the PR disaster that's been going on since Prop 8. And they've done things where they've reached out to the LGBT community here to pass a non-discrimination ordinance in the workplace and housing. In 2009, I think they did that, right after the Prop 8 disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to, you know, get some good PR. So they are capable. Another example, which is pretty funny, is that, you know, they just did this big edict that people who work at the church office building, which is about a 35-story office building, and all the church employees all over Salt Lake, don't have to wear white shirts. The men don't have to wear white shirts anymore. They can wear colored shirts, and women could actually wear pants. And so this is this, you know, huge, right, oh my moment, but I guess nobody does. The men still wear white shirts, and the women still wear, you know, dresses and skirts. So, you know, in spite, so they do change. And I think, you know, more seriously, that the way they are bleeding members, and they're by their own admission, you know, it's like a private company that releases its earnings. Who knows? But they have admitted about every year and a half or so, they gain about 1 million members. Well, the last 2 years, they haven't even gained 800,000 members between the 2 years. It's the last year was the slowest growth rate. This is the church's admission since 1938, in 80 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it tells me, knowing as much as I do about this operation, that is very untruthful, and PR departments, we've seen do that, stretch the truth. They are hurting, and we've seen through internal memos that were leaked. In 2004, they lost 45,000 millennials. This is the whole future of the church. That's a big chunk of a church that had about 9 million members there. And so since then, that was 4 years before Prop 8. It's gotten a lot worse. It was before this November 5th policy change, where they had 25,000 resignations, I think, the first week, of not just millennials, but everybody. So they're having a lot of trouble. So, Carrie, a long answer to your question. Those kind of things, the losing members, you know, which translates to losing revenue, they're going to have to change. And I know they will, and they'll do it sooner rather than later. And it's an easy thing to do, as they did with African-Americans and the polygamy thing. It's just revelation, and it's change, and everyone accepts it.
Well, one other thing as a follow-up, we know that the Catholic Church was engaged in a cover-up of sexual abuse crimes. There is something that, and we know that evangelicals, you know, are very Machiavellian when their goal is, you know, the end times, they're willing to put up with the Donald Trump. But with the Mormon Church, they actually have something called lying for the Lord, which is, you know, kind of a head scratcher, because a lot of people think, well, wait a second, if they're a religious institution, surely they would be spiritual, and surely that would mean that at the core they must be honest. But I remember reading about this concept that has been perpetrated called lying for the Lord, which is that it's okay to lie if you're for the greater truth, for the greater good, which has to do with protecting the church or advancing the cause. Is that correct? And are we going to see more of that in politics, especially around Mike Lee and those guys pushing religious freedom bills?
I'm sure. It's something I laughed at when I first heard it. It's a very accepted fact of the Mormon Church. They have something like 180 people in their public affairs office, which is their political PR office, just in Salt Lake alone. They've got offices all over the world at some of the major temples with the same public affairs office. So, yeah, they take this very seriously. As more and more people have come out and left the church and are telling their stories, there was one guy who really captivated me. Jesse Stays, his name. He was the social media director for the church for 3 years during the 2010 to 2012. So he was there when Romney was running for president the second time and the nominee. But anyway, he said it's very hard to maintain your testimony when you work for the church. Translation is, it's very hard to stay loyal and believing because they're lying about everything. And that's what they do. So if the growth is 1,000 a year, they'll say it's 100,000 in a country. And so time after time after time, these employees are hearing all that. And that's why we're seeing this huge number of leaks that are coming out through this guy I've gotten to know in the last year named Ryan McKnight, who is the whistleblower extraordinaire. He has hundreds, if not thousands, of leaked videos, documents, all kinds of electronic stuff from the church, from the office building, the business side, and he's putting them up on Mormon Leaks and -.ie, and it's great. And he's got a Facebook page too. And this is the thing that, in conjunction with your question, Karen, on abuse, the Mormon Church, this is, we're seeing the very, very tip of the iceberg, because they've had a problem, I think, far worse than the Catholic Church. And there's a video that Ryan McKnight leaked just yesterday, and it's with the number two guy in the church. His name is Dallin Oates. He's in what's called the First Presidency. He is the heir apparent. When this 93-year-old dies, Dallin Oates, who's 85, will succeed him, just like the vice president, kind of, but in a different fashion here. And so, he did this video in 1999. He's this revered legal scholar. He was a law professor at the University of Chicago. He was a Supreme Court justice in the state of Utah. Now he's, so he's a legal scholar. He did this video, which is up on Mormon Leaks, a 20-minute video telling bishops and stake presidents, who are the leaders of the church, when people come to you with sexual abuse, spousal abuse, they've been beaten up, here's what you do. And it's a real interesting watch. It's almost kind of a legal how-to. What they did was to put in a hotline, they called it, which was a number that goes to the church. So if you're a woman like this Rob Porter, those two ex-wives of his who were abused and badly beaten and strangled by him, and they've talked about this, they would go to their bishop, the leader of their area, and tell their story. And the bishop would say, don't say anything. You don't want to jeopardize your husband's career. It's your fault. What have you done to cause him to strike you? Completely turning around. Last thing they do, and it's not once on this 20-minute video from this their legal eagle, to go to the authorities, to go to the police, to seek help outside the church, because the church, all it is, cover up. One last point. And Karen knows this. I went to a trial about 3 weeks ago in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and it's all part of my research. The Mormon Church is on trial in a civil case brought on by this guy, Tim Kossoff, who was one of the lead attorneys who took all the lawsuits against the Catholic Church for all the priest abuse. He was one of the top attorneys on that. He has a whole big team now suing the Mormon Church on behalf of six families whose children, as young as 2 and 4 years old, were abused by this Mormon bishop, prominent family son that they kept moving around. He'd babysit for these different families under the cover of the church. They'd find out about the abuse. They'd go to their bishop, and nothing would happen. So this guy now is in prison for 35 to 75 years. He's only 26 years old. It was a trial like, expect Truman Capote to be in the front row. I heard two different victims of this guy, who of course are cross-examined by these Mormon attorneys trying to discredit their stories. And this church is going to lose this thing big. And the Post did a story about it the first day. There have not been a lot of news coverage. But my prediction is, unless they settle, which they may, because I don't think it's going well for them, and this jury looks like they're just not too taken with this, these slick attorneys, these slick Mormon attorneys, and how they're treating these witnesses and this whole heinous act, that the church is going to have a huge judgment, hundreds of millions of dollars against them, and we'll be hearing about it, which is just the Me Too movement, and there's even something called the Mormon Me Too movement on behalf of women who are trying to get out from under these things. They're not allowed to divorce. It tears apart the family, so they've got to just stick in these abusive relationships and told to do so by these church leaders. So,
and where is this happening again?
It's It is in the town of Martinsburg, West Virginia. It's about an hour and a half outside of D.C., just over the West Virginia border. And I can't imagine the firepower these two opposing counsels are about, you know, 8 or 9 attorneys on each side in this courtroom. And it's a big, big case and could be very costly, and just the tragedy of these families. And these were Mormon families who are now in turn suing their church for allowing cover up and this perpetrator, this abuser, to do what he did. So it's going to be real interesting. And, you know, the church is just having problem after problem after problem. And, you know, it's karma. And until they change their ways, they're going to continue to and damage so many lives.
Thank you.
Fred, a few minutes ago, Karen mentioned about the stance on gay people, the sort of you could be gay, but you couldn't act on it kind of thing. There was sort of a trend about 2 years ago, and I don't know that this was something directly mandated from the church or just inspired by it, but there were different coming out, if you will, of families within the Mormon church where gay men were marrying straight women, and it was sort of implied that this was the way gay men should handle themselves. There was a PBS show, My Husband is Gay, which had a bunch of these families coming together in sort of a support group fashion. And there was a blogger named Josh Weed who came out and wrote about it extensively, about he was fully acknowledging that he was a gay man, but he chose to marry a straight woman. They had 3 daughters. Recently, Josh Weed and his wife announced they were divorcing. They completely reversed their position on whether this had been a good idea and, in fact, said it was not, that the intimacy that, you know, your orientation brings to the relationship is a necessity. I was wondering whether the church had a stance on this, whether you felt they were trying to perpetuate this, and what their current viewpoint or feeling on it was now that it's sort of unraveling publicly.
Yeah, it's you know, no surprise to those, to many of us, that this marriage fell apart, the sham marriage that was going on. So, you know, the church has a long history of trying to turn LGBT people straight because it's a numbers game. And if, you know, you have a gay person who's not going to get married and not have kids, you lose, you know, 8 members, 8 potential members. But if you tell this person through licensed Mormon therapists who they think they can trust, or these lay bishops and stake presidents, you know, just you have to just kind of own up this, get married to somebody of the opposite sex, have kids, you'll be fine. And that has been going on, which is why my reference earlier to the guy jokingly call it a gay problem, because there are just so many gay people in the Mormon faith, because for so many generations it's get married, have kids, you'll be fine. And that, you know, I happen to believe in the gay gene theory, certainly holds true in my family and many others. So I think that that has kept this gay population thriving. And in Utah particularly, it's just there's so many LGBT people here, many of whom have moved from other parts of the country. They may have grown up in California or Michigan or something, but they kind of a safe space here. It's first generation leaving a church, like a lot of these strong things. Some might even call this cult-like. It's very, very difficult because you are shunned by your family, your whole social structure, family structure, which is, you know, just put such a huge priority on, and particularly in the Mormon faith, they're together, you know, 24/7, and then that's cut off. It's just so damaging. So there are a lot of problems, but there's a lot of encouragement now. They're doing wonderful things. There are resources here. There's something called Encircle House, which was started by the nephew and niece of a gay, wealthy gay man from Salt Lake. They started it as this beautiful home in Provo, Utah, right across from this Mormon temple there. But it welcomes 60, 80 LGBTQ kids a day. It's where the university is, and then also the high school. And it's a safe, welcoming place, and they do all kinds of fun activities, and they even get them in parades, a gay pride parade and all that. So there are good things happening, and it's just it's as a result of the church leadership kind of backing away a little They're not as hard line, and then you're getting courageous Mormons in one group, which is when the history books are written, the real heroines of this movement is the Mormon moms of LGBT kids. They call themselves Mama Dragons, and their leader is Wendy Williams Montgomery, who, when her son came out at 13 in Bakersfield, California, he was shunned. He wasn't allowed to pass the communion basket, which all those kids at that age do, and he was just kind of blackballed from the church. And so she had it. They moved to Arizona because where it'd be a safer place for him. And she's become an active, and there are a lot. There are dozens of these moms, and they are the best. They're they're just not taking it. They're putting their children before their church. Believe it or not, but that has to be really thought through and courageously taken on. And so there are a lot of good things going on. Kids are getting better. The legislature, I mean, there's some crazy stuff going on in the legislature here. I had met with Troy Williams, who's the executive director, a great friend, an amazing man at, of Equality Utah, kinds of things that these legislatures having to take up on. And I forget the term, you'll know, Garrett, surely that a transgender person after reassignment surgery then has to get the birth certificate changed. There's a reporting or there's a term for that.
And I so don't recall at the moment.
There's a, like, it's a bigger deal here. There are a lot of states that, you know, it's automatic, many that aren't. And so I guess the courts here on one particular case of somebody who's very prominent Mormon family had a reassignment surgery, wanted to get the birth certificate redone. They wouldn't, so they went to court. And then the judge said to the legislature, you need to address this. So you can imagine it's 80% Mormon, this legislature here, having to deal with transgender, you know, reassignment surgery, changing birth certificates. So this is the kind of stuff that, you know, they're supporting it too. And they're dealing with, and so it's people coming out, children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews of some of the highest ranking Mormons. One of the apostles has an openly gay brother who's revered. One of the apostles is Dallin Oates, I mentioned, actually a member of the First Presidency, has a gay grandson he's very close to. There are a lot of others, and that's, you know, what's going to get some of these older, you know, far-right conservative men to change their positions, because, you know, they know somebody, and they know someone in their family or their neighbors, and I'm hearing story after story after story. So I do have hope that it will change sooner than a lot of the ex-Mormons think it will, because it has to. And they're moving in that direction.
Well, Brody, you have a question?
Yeah, Fred, the Republican Party these days is not your daddy's Oldsmobile. It's not your daddy's Republican Party. You know, you've sat on several panels. You participated numerous times during the different cycles. And I think looking at this and looking ahead, and we're talking more than just Utah now, what is it going to take to shift the Republican Party back into a mode where some of the polarity goes away? Because at this point, there's so much divisiveness, even within the party itself, that they are unable to govern. And part of that is reflected, as you've just stated eloquently, by some of these religious turmoil and infighting. Give me a quick Fred Carter viewpoint of what it's going to take to kind of shift the party back to a different sense of prioritizing governing.
Well, there are two tracks on that. One, as we're certainly seeing in California, but all over the country, the fastest growing party is no political party at all. It's either decline to state or independent, or some people check American independent because they think that's independent, but that's where the numbers are moving. And it's not just the Republican Party's problem. It's the Democratic Party's problem, too. It's the dysfunction in both parties that are driving people to become independent. And that way they, you know, depending on the state, you can vote in primaries or not, but people are just more comfortable with that decision. So, you know, we have that on one hand. So the parties, not unlike the Mormon Church, are losing members. So the other thing is, when I got involved in politics, in Republican politics in California, was 1976, when I was working for President Ford, who's being challenged by Ronald Reagan. I still have a lot of the Reagan people from, 50 years ago or 40 years ago, who won't talk to me because because I was supporting him, who was, of course, then perceived much more moderate than Reagan, who was the conservative. And this was an interesting time because Watergate had just happened, and the Republican Party was in shambles in 76 because Ford had pardoned Nixon, and Watergate, of course, several years of that, and it just everybody left the Republican Party, particularly young people. So Reagan didn't win in 76, but he certainly did in 80. And here's this, I don't know, wasn't as old as Trump, but well into his 70, or, I guess close to 70, taking over the presidency, and he brought back the Republican Party single-handedly, and he brought back younger people, and not just the, the log cabin, a lot of kind of the young professionals getting out of college, going into the workforce, were coming back to the Republican Party. So it might just take one person if the system isn't broken by then, and it may well be where the, the decline to state independence rule and their majorities in many states and getting close to that in California, or we may get, a Democrat to kind of do that, unite the country and the party, or a Republican to do that, unite the Republican Party in the country. But who knows? We got a rocky road until then.
Okay, well, and I've got a quick follow-up to that. Let me ask you this, Fred. I'm Canadian, and obviously we have a parliamentary form of government. Our mother country, the UK, same thing. There's a lot of those governments. When the governments don't work, they fall, and they have to be a coalition. Traditionally, for the last, basically the entirety of your nation's history, it evolved into this two-party system, which is now proven to be fairly unworkable. Do you envision a third, fourth, or fifth party and a coalition form of governing that maybe can broach and overcome some of these problems?
Again, I think it could come down to an individual, the kind of president to really, Obama almost did it, but he was a little polarizing just coming in for who he was. But, we might see that. I had been a strong advocate, not that I could do much, of Michael Bloomberg running in 2016, and he was toying with it, if you recall, and it would take somebody like him to run as an independent who had $1 billion to spend, because that's what it would take to get these states to allow you on the ballot. The two parties have done an excellent job of freezing out third-party attempts. We've seen some going, but not with the type of politics, kind of centrist politics of Bloomberg, his communication and just his whole story and his money in order to get on those ballots. And I'm sure they did polling then. He couldn't win, and Hillary's that was even before Trump. But had he gotten in with the unhappiness with those two party nominees, and had he come through fairly unscathed, he could have won. So I think there is a chance, an opportunity for a third party candidate for a variety of reasons I've gone over, and I think the timing is probably getting close.
Okay, fair enough.
Fred,
Rob?
Yeah. Fred, I'm sure you're aware that yesterday we had the 18th school shooting in the United States in the last 45 days, and a lot of us Americans are completely sick of it happening, because throughout all those shootings and all the ones before them, literally nothing has been done to stop it. One of the former GOP politicians in Florida came out today and actually stated that because of the NRA influence in Congress, the only way anything would ever get done is if the Democrats took control. Do you agree with that? And if not, what do you see as the prescription for getting a hold of this gun violence that's going on in our country and is unique to our country?
Yeah, it is, sadly. And I guess we're still the Wild West. We're duels and all that. It's so much a part of our history. I'm, of course, not justifying, but I think that that's part of our DNA. People need guns, want guns, for the wrong reasons more often than not. And so I don't know how you fix that. I went to the Pulse nightclub almost to the day of the year anniversary, and last year. And, oh, my God. You know, it really, one thing to see these, we do get a little, you know, pardon to all of this, and the news cycle is shorter for each one of these terrible tragedies, and it's just hard to believe they continue. But when you get into that, and there's a great memorial set up with a fence around the fence, and this nightclub, and picture that, and the, you know, relate to being in gay bars, and it's just, you know, those kind of tragedies are just indescribable, and when it's brought closer to home, it's just that much tougher. The gun lobby, I think it's something like, I've heard, they have 450 employees, the NRA, just in the Alexandria, Virginia office, which is their main office, but they have offices all over the country, and the many, many consultants, I was told, and those are ex-senators, those kind of heavy-duty lobbyists, I'm sure. So, you know, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing very effectively. So much so that, yeah, unless there's a dramatic change in leadership, and plenty of Democrats. Don't forget Bernie Sanders, a great progressive, is, you know, from a very pro-gun state in Vermont. So his position is a little different than a lot of Democrats. And Democrats aren't many left in the South, but other pro-gun states make it tough, too. So it is definitely the Republican Party facilitating the NRA, and the, which is really, I'm sure, the gun manufacturers and plenty of owners. But they're doing their job, and I don't know. I mean, what more could it take than a school shooting to get effective laws passed, or that senseless Vegas, you know, shooting with 49, or how many was that, 59 or something? Yeah. I mean, just it's mixed up. Yeah. There's so many. Well, so it's tragedy after tragedy of the worst sort. You would think something would happen. I've long been an advocate of controlling our manufacturing and guns and ammunition and everything else. We have to get it under control, and that's government's role.
No, I agree with you, and I hope you move forward in your party, because it's my shock as a parent started with Newtown, and if we couldn't do anything after 27 little children, which tore me to pieces, were killed, then I really get a huge cynical bent on our whole political system after that, because that, if there was anything, there was a call to action. But it's also not just black or white of guns versus non-guns. It's also, we are in an age of these automatic weapons that are the most efficient killing machines over bombs, knives, any other vehicle, that certainly regulation around the types of weaponry that is allowed in the public seems called for, and we have no movement whatsoever. I do appreciate your comment on it. Karen, did you have a further question?
Well, actually, I want to say happy belated birthday, Fred Karger. You know,
thank you.
Here we are, late and, you know, long in the tooth and still active as hell. So I think that's really important. And just to mention your MormonTips.com again, because I think that if people want to find out what you're doing, and not only the cartoon video, but you have other videos there as well. And I think you have your Californians Against Hate archive there as well, or is that at rightsequalrights.com?
All pretty connected, but yeah, Rights Equal Rights has our Californians Against Hate, which was through the Prop 8 campaign. We did a lot of the boycotts, as I mentioned, successfully, of the biggest donors to shut them down, many of whom have either died or stopped contributing, not by death, but by their own willingness after getting embarrassed,
Fred,
or boycotted. And yes.
We are at the end of the program, I'm afraid. I want to thank you so much for coming on. You are invited back anytime. We would love to hear your viewpoint and your position and insights. I want to thank Brody and Karen, as always, for your expertise on our panel. Stay tuned next week for another exciting episode of Rated LGBT Radio. We'll be right here at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Also listen to Out in Santa Cruz on KSCO.com on Saturday nights, 7 p.m. Pacific Time and 10 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm Rob Watson, and for our team here tonight, I'd like to say goodnight, and as always, thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.